Good morning and welcome to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. It's the weekly program about health, nutrition, fitness, and lifestyle in general. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I am Dave Cushing. Good morning. And this morning we speak with Linda Kang about her new book, Quackery, A Brief History of the Worst Ways to Cure Everything. This is a full survey of the weird and wacky measures taken throughout history to solve medical issues. Sounds amazing.
Yes. From leeches to mercury to arsenic. You know, all those things that heal you.
Yeah, all those things that are in my medicine cabinet.
Yeah, sure. Then we'll speak with Renee Huang to talk about her new outdoor-oriented group for women. It's called the Wild Women Tribe, seeking to bring forward transformation through wilderness experiences.
And then finally, Katie Wang and Courtney Kaplan will come in and tell us about the Eats, Food, and Film weekend at the Jim Santee Auditorium as part of the Park City Film Series. They have three amazing movies about food. One is super interesting about food waste, contemporary issue.
That's right. That one's airing on Sunday, followed by a panel discussion. The others, there's one about noodles and...
And then The Big Sick, the comedy from last summer about the Pakistani stand-up comedian whose Anglo wife takes super ill, and it's a family drama that should be amazing to hear about.
That's right. This is The Mountain Life. Stay with us. We'll be back after these words from our underwriters.
Valley Behavioral Health is a local nonprofit and proud supporter of KPCW. We are your community behavioral health center and provide a broad range of services, including individual, family, couples, and group therapy for mental health and substance abuse. We serve all ages in all of Summit County. Please check out our website at valleycares.com or 649-8347 for more information.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with my co-host Dave Cushing.
How was your Halloween?
It was so fun. It was fun. I love Halloween on Main Street from 3 until 5. It is just...
It's wild with the people, the kids, the dogs, even here at the station, Candy with mm-hmm. Randy. People come up. And then I had randomly put together a Pharaoh outfit.
Oh.
And I stood in front of the Egyptian pitching the Pharaoh Club. Not really, but I met some Cleopatras. And meanwhile, back in New Jersey, my daughter was dressed as Cleopatra. And we didn't even know that each other were doing
synchronicities,
this.
Dave.
Right on.
It's always nice to meet a few Cleopatras when you're out there on the street.
Yeah.
Nice.
Them and some Knights Templar and the lawn gnomes were pretty amazing last night. There was a family of lawn gnomes. There was also a family of snow men, women, and children.
I miss those. Oh, such great costumes. I love it. Okay, well, let's shift gears into our program and welcome our first guest, Lydia Kang. She's written a book called Quackery, A Brief History of the Worst Ways to Cure Everything. This, again, is a historical survey of everything we've done with good intention that has, you know, either maimed or killed people in the name of saving them with great medical miracles. It's all about quackery throughout the times. And Lydia Kang, thank you so much for joining us on The Mountain Life.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, your book, Quackery, is so much fun, and I can't, I was thinking as I was reading through it that just, you know, the sheer history is interesting, but the sheer entertainment that you must have experienced while you were researching this book was probably made it worth it to you, right?
Oh, absolutely. It was entertaining all the way and illuminating and just so interesting. There were actually many times when Nate and I would drop what we were doing and start texting each other over the interesting things that we were finding because they were pretty unbelievable.
Right. So, yeah, you've co-written this with Nate Peterson, and he's sort of the historian, and you are the doctor behind this. But basically, you two went through, how did you research this book? It's so interesting to find all the quackery, I mean, the biggest compilation of quackery that I've ever come across.
Well, the interesting thing was we sort of divvied up the different chapters because each of us had particular interests in certain things. And so I particularly wanted to do the surgical chapter and the mercury chapter. Nate thought strychnine was really fascinating and alcohol. So we ended up just each diving into each subject matter kind of as deep as we could go, finding as many resources as we could, going into the medical literature as well as historical references to see where some of these treatments were being used. And it got pretty deep, and so sometimes we had to really trim out a lot of the excessive stuff so that we could just focus on some of the highlights of each medical treatment.
That's really interesting. And what led you to start researching this quackery topic to begin with?
You know, it's interesting because I think I had an interest in a lot of these subjects for a long time, and it never occurred to me to do anything about it. And Nate, being a journalist, we have a mutual friend in common, which is Nate's wife, who is also an author of young adult fiction, like I am.
Right.
And we were just talking together and thinking, like, it would be really great to write a nonfiction book together, but what would it be? And Nate thought, you know, quacks would be really fun. And I immediately said, I just lit up and I said, yes, that would be amazing. Let's just do a little bit of looking into see what we can find. And before we knew it, we had just, you know, opened up this treasure trove of so many different topics and thought there is definitely enough to cover here. And I think we can do it in a way that feels really fresh and really approachable for the general audience. So we just went with it. And this is what happened.
Have you been able to write some columns for some of the medical magazines that you've also published in on this quack topic?
Not yet. Interestingly, most of the interviews and posts that we have done have been for things like Mental Floss and Time Magazine, but not as yet for the actual medical journals that I've published in prior to this, but it could still happen, so who knows?
Sure.
Right. Well, before we get into what I want to ask about, which are mercury and strychnine, we often use the moniker, I guess, or we call whatever that would encapsulate quackery, excuse me, as being snake oil. So I'm wondering, what was the origin of snake oil?
Well, that is such an interesting story because snake oil and what goes with it, the snake oil salesman, was a very, very real thing that happened. There was this gentleman named Clark Stanley, who during the 1893 Columbian Exposition in Chicago decided that he was going to sell this snake oil liniment. And the idea comes from a real medicine, actually. You know, there were some thoughts that people had been using snake oil as a treatment for joint pain and some other things. And there was a wave of Chinese immigration to the American West, and they had been using a snake oil salve that came from Chinese water snakes, which is very high in omega-3 acids and actually has anti-inflammatory properties. So he took this idea and said, well, I'm going to make it my own, but of course there's no Chinese snakes in the United States, so he used rattlesnakes, which don't have a lot of fat. So when he did this big exposition, it was this big show, and he started bottling it, and people started to buy it. But by the time they actually evaluated what he was selling, there wasn't any snake in it at all. So that's kind of where the whole idea of the snake oil salesman and this snake oil treatment that is a complete fraud came from.
Right. Oh, that's fun. That's a great story. So mercury, now that the most tiny amount of mercury that is found in our raw fish or in our vaccines, we're so careful about and we're so scared of. But we used to use mercury on a regular basis to quote unquote heal. So how did we use it?
So mercury was used for a lot of things for quite a long time. I mean, for thousands of years. One of the things is that mercury, the mercury salt that was often used, was also called, one of them was called calomel, and it was a commonly used medicine for hundreds of years. And when you took it, it made you, unfortunately, have a lot of diarrhea, and people thought that this was a very good thing. They thought if you can, quote, unquote, purge your body, it would sort of balance out a lot of these problems in it. That harkens back to, you know, the humoral theory of medicine. So it was used for purging when you felt bad, if for any reason, fatigue, depression. If you had a fever, you would use it. For a while, calomel was put into teething powder. So little babies that were teething and were cranky, moms would rub this teeth powder into their gums, and then they would get mercury poisoning.
Oh.
So it was used for so many different things, and it's just an awful concept if you think about it, because we are really quite afraid of mercury, and for good reason.
And so at what point and what year was it figured out that we were poisoning our babies?
So I think it wasn't really until the mid-20th century that they understood why these babies were getting sick from, it was called Pink's disease, because the children's skin would turn pink and the skin would peel off. And it wasn't until, I want to say it was like around the 1950s or so, that they realized that this was all a result of mercury. So at that point in time, they made very sure to try to keep mercury away from these teething powders. And over the course of time, they have been pulling mercury away from a lot of different products. And so that is why actually today, if you go into your local pharmacy and you buy yourself a traditional thermometer, it doesn't have mercury in it. It usually has red-colored alcohol, because we are trying to take mercury out of everyday objects now.
Well, when my dentist was replacing my fillings in the 80s, was that because there was some mercury in the fillings I got
mercury,
in the 60s?
Yeah. So mercury amalgams, which are combinations of mercury and other metals, were used as filling. And there's a lot of controversy over how healthy these are. So I'm not going to tread too far into that, except to say that the amount of mercury is not supposed to be so much that it causes problems, but I'm sure there are lots of people who would disagree with that. I think that nowadays, if no one gets a mercury amalgam, or it's less common to see because they have these other compounds that they can use to do fillings, and they don't have to worry about any kind of heavy metal issues whatsoever. But that comes up quite often. People really still worry about their mercury fillings. Should they do something about it? I recommend people talk to their doctor and their dentist about it.
Of course. And the mercury heading is in one of the sections of the book. And I just want to say I like how it's organized. The first section's called Elements. And so it includes treatises on mercury, antimony, arsenic, etc. Then there's Plants and Soil, Tools, Animals, Mysterious Powders, or Powers, rather. But they also have a number of sections called The Hall of Shame. And I was looking at the Women's Health Hall of Shame, which is a lot about reproduction and procreation and ancient and not so ancient stimuli for either having a kid or not having a kid. Where'd you get this idea? That's pretty cute.
Well, we knew that for a very, very long time, a lot of the medicine surrounding women's health was really dictated by men. And that in and of itself was a bit of a problem. So we knew that there were going to be just a wealth of really terrible quack remedies for all sorts of women's health problems. So it wasn't very hard to find, to be honest. They're everywhere. So we picked a couple of the highlights. I think one of my favorites is how there was a first century scholar who recommended putting the right foot of a hyena on a pregnant woman to help with delivery. But she couldn't use the left foot of the hyena because that would be really bad. It's so mind-blowing how strange and odd some of these treatments are, so we had to include some of those.
Right. pretty interesting.
Well, since Dave brought up the Women's Hall of Shame, let's talk about the Male Hall of Shame and the things that we used to use in place of Viagra, for example.
Oh, there were a lot of different things that they tried to help with men's energy levels and their sexuality. And probably, my goodness, I'm like actually worried about saying any of these on air. But suffice it to say, supplements and electricity and all sorts of other things that you could put inside your body or outside your body to help with men's vigor were used. And in the animal section in particular, implanted monkey and goat glands were a very, very big thing in the early 20th century. That people tried to do to restore virility, and they didn't work.
Right.
Because you can't just implant parts of other animals into your body and just assume they're going to keep producing testosterone. Your body attacks them and destroys them, and they stop working. So that was that.
So I guess that this all leads me to wonder, Dr. Kang, if we, 100 years ago, is it just that we had blind hope? Is it that we so revered our medical community that we would believe anything? Or do you feel that, we're much the same now? We just have hope, blind hope, about different sorts of things within medical practice?
I think that that's a really complicated question, and it's a really good question, because in the past, it's easier to see why they made these choices about these awful treatments. One was that they didn't always have a really great understanding of how the human body worked or how a woman's body worked. So they were kind of guessing and making some assumptions and thought, well, if we need to, make our hearts healthy, maybe we'll use something that like gold, because it's like the sun and the sun is warming and that would be good for the heart. And they made these sort of magical associations to come up with these ideas. On top of that, they would often treat things that the symptoms would go away after a while on their own, like the common cold or a flu or something like that. Even things like syphilis, like after it got really bad, sometimes it would go away for a year or two, and people would think, wow, that mercury really worked because the problem went away. Well, it didn't go away. The disease sort of quieted down on its own, and so that made people think that things were working when they weren't. Nowadays, I think it's very different. We do know a lot more about the body, but we don't know everything. And I think because of that, there leaves a lot of room for people to step in and say, we have a better way, and this is going to work better and faster than what traditional medicine is working. And, in some cases, it really is a simple, we need to expand our views of what can be possibilities. But the flip side of that is they need to be studied rigorously. And repeatedly, so that we don't just take one person's, word for, oh, this definitely works. We have to really look and see, because we can do that these days about what works and what doesn't.
That's what I was going to say, that we live in the era of peer-reviewed studies that are repeated over and over again to prove that things actually work. But even in this era, can you shed light on the current state of quackery? Are there areas that people should raise their eyes at?
Yes. Well, I would say, there are a lot of areas where quackery is still very much alive and well. Probably homeopathy is one of the ones that is brought up over and over again. In my mind, from a scientific point of view, it just doesn't make sense to me. And I don't think the studies have really panned out to support that it works. I think in cancer quackery, that is a huge, huge area. And I would, urge people to find some, trusted sources like the Memorial Sloan Cancer Center website for patients that really discusses quackery and can point people in the right direction about, well, what has been studied and how has it been studied and does this really harm people? Because some of these treatments can really harm people when there are options that might save lives that their doctors give.
If you're just joining us, our guest is Dr. Lydia Kang. She's a practicing internal medicine physician, and an author of young adult fiction, and now this adult fiction, well, no, nonfiction.
Yeah.
It's actually nonfiction, which is really scary. It's called Quackery, A Brief History of the Worst Ways to Cure Everything. And from an ice pick lobotomy, which was kind of interesting, to the first malpractice trial in history. It's this is horrific. It's called a lithotomy to remember. And I don't imagine that most people know what a lithotomy is. Can you tell us?
Sure. So a lithotomy is the removal of a stone. It can be from any part of the urinary tract, so in the bladder or in the ureters, which are the tubes that connect your kidneys to the bladder. But one of the worst lithotomies that ever happened, unfortunately, did happen in the mid-1700s. And I think I have that date wrong. But it happened in England when,
no, that's right.
Unfortunately, this gentleman was having a lithotomy done by a surgeon who was not very experienced. And what normally should take a couple of minutes went on for a whopping 55 minutes. And the patient was screaming the entire time, like, forget it, just leave it in there. I don't want to do this anymore. And in the end, his incompetency, excuse me, was disclosed. And the doctor sued him for saying that in public. And so it was this trial that went on and exposed that there are these physicians who were doing things that they didn't know what they were doing. And the lithotomy itself was a pretty awful procedure at the time because there wasn't anesthesia. Was certainly a lithotomy to remember.
Right. And of course, we don't want to share the gory details with our listeners. It was sort of the good part of the story, I have to say. But yeah. Without anesthesia, this is incredible. When did we come to have anesthesia for surgery?
So anesthesia we've been trying to do anesthesia for thousands of years. We've tried things like opium and, unfortunately, knocking people on the head. But things like chloroform and ether really got more attention in the 1800s. And so by the late 1800s, they were able to do surgery with these anesthetics, and it really completely changed the face of surgery. Because before that, when someone did do surgery, because the patient was awake and feeling pain, they had to do it as quickly as possible. Once they had anesthesia in place, surgeons could take their time. That wasn't always a good thing because it meant higher risk for infection because they were doing things for longer periods of time and they weren't exactly aseptic at the time. So, there was a lot of experimentation going on trying to find good anesthetics. A lot of the people who were trying to find these new ones were experimenting on themselves. So it's pretty, not exactly how things are done today. So, that's around the time that things were really starting to get going. And nowadays, we don't have to really worry about feeling pain when we go get a tooth pulled or have an amputation or something like that.
Right.
I like the anecdotes you had about skull moss. And I wonder if you could tell our listeners about skull moss and how did you even hear of it?
So skull moss is part of the chapter on cannibalism and corpse medicine, which was one of my favorite chapters because it was so particularly gruesome and strange to me.
Right.
That I didn't know this as a practicing physician. I did not know that cannibalism and corpse medicine was a big part of the pharmacopoeia in the last couple of hundred years. So it was a big shock for me to find this out. And one of these was skull moss. So apparently, if you left a skull out in the elements, it would eventually, the flesh would fall off and a nice moss would grow over the top of the calvarium or the skull. And they would take this moss off and use it for all sorts of treatments, particularly one of the favorite ones was you could shove it up your nose to stop a nosebleed, which I think is kind of funny because I think if you shoved a Kleenex or a handkerchief up your nose, it probably would have done the same thing. But they thought it was magically helpful, so that's what they used.
The skull moss. And what about blood jam? What can you tell the listeners about blood jam?
Oh, blood jam. So blood was used as a treatment for so many different things. It was used for epilepsy. It was used to help with vigor and make people feel younger, so they thought. And blood jam was one way of taking blood. Some people found that drinking fresh human blood was not enjoyable, which is understandable. So they had a recipe for blood jam from, I think it's from 1679, where you let the blood dry for a while and let the watery part drip away, and you push it through a sieve, and then you have this jam that you can eat that to help with all the medical problems that you had. So, yeah, it wasn't just straight off blood. Sometimes they made it into jam and ate it that way. So,
wow. You know, as you go through your book, you find all of these just incredulous things. And then you get to this point in the book where you describe some practices that we use every single day. And the way you word them, and it all has to do with what we still use from an animal for our medicines. Could you go through that? Insulin.
Oh, sure.
For example.
Like leeches, for instance.
Well, the leeches, yeah, leeches are still used all around the world, right?
Leeches are still used. I think a lot of people still use leeches for some more kind of ancient remedies. However, mainstream medicine does use leeches, but in a very narrow therapeutic way. So in the past, leeches were used for anything from stomach aches to cramps to headaches. If you had a problem, they would just slap on a leech and hope that it, you know, got better. These days, because leeches, when they bite you, they suck the blood and they have a blood thinner in their saliva. It helps an area continue to bleed a little bit after the leech stops biting. So some surgeons will use it in a place where a very, very delicate surgery has taken place. So, for example, like the tip of the nose or fingertip, where if that area swelled a lot, it might cut off the blood supply and kill off that new tissue. So a leech bite would help decompress some of that swollen blood that might be inside that fresh tissue, and allow the bleeding to continue so that it didn't get so tight that it cut off its own blood supply. So some surgeons still use that today.
In Nebraska?
Yes, I believe there.
I believe you're there.
Nebraska. I've talked to some of my surgeon friends and asked them, and they said it does get used. It's not super common, and
right.
It depends on the type of surgeon. So it's not every surgeon that would use it. It would be someone doing very particular types of surgeries. So, yeah, it happens.
Right. So sometimes we don't know really where our food comes from, but a lot of times still we don't know where our medicine comes from. Think of the cures for diabetes, for menopause, for preventing blood clotting. Could you talk about some of those that we still use that, if you word it the right way, it sounds still really kind of gross.
It is true. We don't think about this, but insulin can be used for diabetes, as everybody knows, but the insulin can come from the pancreatic secretions of a pig. Some people will use lanolin on their skin. You can buy it in the supermarket or in the pharmacy right now for dry skin. And lanolin is actually the oil glands that come from a sheep. So you're basically taking, you know, when people are always saying, like, oh, my skin's oily and it's giving me acne, that's the stuff from sheep that you're putting on your skin. It's like that same kind of material to help with your dry skin. Other things like there was a hormone replacement therapy that was containing estrogen, and it was derived from the urine of pregnant horses. So yeah. That's still on the market. And heparin, a blood thinner, used to actually come from the membranes, the intestinal membranes of pigs and cows. So we still really do lean on animals to help us with treatment that we use all the time.
Yeah, good thing we don't eat them. Oh, we do.
Oh, we still do.
Oh, shoot. Wait.
Well, the book is wonderful. It's very entertaining. I would suggest it for, say the young person who has decided they want to go to medical school and they just eat this stuff up. The book is called Quackery, A Brief History of the Worst Ways to Cure Everything. Dr. Lydia King and Nate Peterson. And Lydia, thank you so much for joining us today on The Mountain Life.
Thank you so much for having me.
And that was Lydia Kang, her new book, Quackery. Very interesting stuff there. Stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment. We're going from quackery into talking about wild women. It's The Mountain Life. Stay with us.
Hi, I'm Whitney Wall from Park City Mountain and proud supporter of KPCW. Park City Mountain hosts winter events throughout the season, including Snowfest, the annual Torchlight Parade, New Year's Eve celebration, Spring Groove, and more. More information about all the events happening at Park City Mountain this winter can be found at parkcitymountain.com.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, healthy living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with my co-host Dave Cushing.
Hi, Lynn.
Hi, Dave. Well, how about, this is not so much for you, Dave, but would you like to meet other like-minded women seeking to deepen their understanding of their unique purpose and life journey, or experience wilderness adventure in your own backyard, or expand your mind and outlook of the world through a guided discussion surrounding a central universal paradigm, a core belief, or a principle? Well, I'd like to hear more about it. We're joined now by the founder of the Wild Women Tribe, Renee Wong, to talk about this new outdoor-oriented group for women. It's the Wild Women Tribe, bringing forward transformation through wilderness experiences. Good morning, Renee. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Lynn and Dave. Thanks for having me.
So how did this all begin? I mean, it sounds great. It sounds like a more organized version of what a lot of us already do, but it's about the structure, I think, that holds the key, maybe, well, in what you do within the experience.
It's so funny because it really kind of happened organically and through the passions and the hobbies that a bunch of my girlfriends already do. We would go on these hiking trips and camping trips and incorporate all these adventure activities and then have these really soulful moments of connection around the campfire, you know, where we're sharing good food and good drink. And two springs ago, 2016, a bunch of us, there were about a dozen of us from different friend circles, came together, went to Moab, had an amazing time camping, 2 days, and we posted some pictures on Facebook, and there was us mountain biking and having like a spill on a river rafting trip, and a whole bunch of our networks, other women in our networks, chimed in and said, wait a minute, I want to do that. That looks like so much fun. And so it kind of sprung organically from that moment.
Mm-hmm. So you've got the adventure side, but you're also weaving into it sort of a lesson or an opportunity for transformation or connecting it to some sort of spiritual endeavor. You're starting off your first one, and you're just launching now, even though it's been in the formation for a while, but you'll be going to Diamond Fork Hot Springs, right?
Yes.
Is that what it's? Yeah.
Yeah.
And you're taking Allison Page, who is the one who has made Trail Talk so famous in this area. So she'll be walking and talking about identity. I think you have a theme with each one. Is that right?
Exactly. I think the central focus of this type of group is that it's wilderness adventure that is leading and giving the forum for transformation. So these experiences are outdoors. Allison has lots of great resources on her website about what being outside does to the brain and how it just opens your mind up, expands your mind, and gives you kind of opportunity for growth and revitalization that we can't get from sitting inside a conference room or around a table indoors. So our first two, we're calling them Wanders, are November 11th and 18th, and we're going to go to the Diamond Fork Hot Springs outside of Spanish Fork, take a little wander, soak in the natural pools that are there, and then, yeah, Allison will be leading a talk on identity. And I think these central overarching topics are really what I'm really attached to, and I think that a lot of people can get a great deal of depth out of. We have other topics planned over the next couple months that incorporate motivation and boundaries and vulnerability and self-worth. And so I think rather than just focusing on something that's maybe work-related or spirituality-related or athletic pursuits, it's really something broad that people from all walks and ages and stages can relate to.
That's interesting. We had Allison in here at the beginning of the summer. She's a therapist who has developed this trail talk methodology of psychotherapy, and I can see where she'd be pretty important in an identity discussion. Now, coming up on your schedule, you want to have sessions in January and March and May every couple of months. Can you talk more about some of the other topics, motivation, boundaries, what those mean to you, what your people might get out of that kind of discussion?
Yeah, I mean, I think that as we move through life and our different stages, there are central themes no matter how old we are or where we are in our careers or how we relate to our children, that we can really give this time and thought to ourselves to dig deep and really find purpose within ourselves. And it doesn't really have anything to do with our roles as mothers and sisters and friends and daughters and whatever career we are. But I think having these moments where we really focus on ourselves can be gratifying. And I think as women, we tend to put ourselves last. So I'm really hoping to create a space where, you know, you set aside a day and you go and you have moments where you can look at, you know, boundaries. I mean, that's such a simple concept, but I think a lot of us have challenges with boundaries. You know, how do you say no? How do you let people down? How do you get over that feeling of potentially hurting someone's feelings?
We were just talking about boundaries before you arrived when we were off air. We were talking about boundaries and how difficult it is. But wonderful to think about empowering people to be able to set up their boundaries, to say no, to know that you're not really letting someone down. That it's all okay. And do these come from things that you've experienced in your lifetime? I'm sitting here thinking of our conversation that we had just before we went on air, and it was I was thinking about reinvention. It sounds like you've had a lot of reinvention in your lifetime, and women very often do completely reinvent themselves, especially if they've, for example, stayed home with kids, and then they're back into the workforce. Complete reinvention, even if they've stayed in the workforce.
Yeah, I think that we're kind of these magical creatures who go through life and are often the glue for our families.
Yeah.
And reinvention is something that I can really identify with. You know, I'm from Canada. I lived in Mexico. I moved to Park City. I mean, I've been all over the place. You know, I've gone through divorce and different relationship challenges. And one of the reasons identity, I think, is a big central topic that has come up through discussions with my girlfriends is that, you know, how we present ourselves is so interesting because you'll meet someone for the first time and you'll introduce yourself and then you'll say what your job is.
Yeah.
Right. And is that really who we are as people? I don't think so. But it's what we go to. And it's where we a lot of times feel like our self-worth is based.
Yeah.
Right. So identity, what we're discussing in November, really is about cracking that open and looking at how do we identify ourselves and how do we allow others to place worth or value on us? Or furthermore, how we do that to ourselves.
I wonder how many of us have ever thought of something different to say when we get asked that. Oh, and what do you do? Oh, I practice being a powerful, wonderful woman. I've never thought of saying something else.
Right. And so it's about kind of bringing that to the forefront and saying, well, what if you said what your passion was or what your purpose is or what you are working on right now that brings you joy?
Yeah. I like it. I'm going to practice that this week. Go ahead, Dave.
Well, on the first meetup you're doing on the meetups on the 11th and the 18th, you'll be at Diamond Fork Hot Springs. And what do you have some locations sketched out for what you want to do in January and March and May? Or
I have
the group take vote on that, or how's it going to shape up?
Well, so another component is really partnering with local businesses and people here in Park City and Summit County who are doing amazing things. And so I have a couple people I'm talking to. So stay tuned. I'm not ready to announce anything yet, but in the snowy months, you know, I envision doing a snowshoe or a skate ski somewhere or something outdoors that's fun and in the snow.
Right. And then you'll have in March, like this discussion about boundaries, you envision bringing in another co-leader who has experience in that field.
Absolutely, because I don't. Right, you know, I'm just the connector. And I think as I've been trying to find purpose, I realize that connection is something that I love to do. There's nothing that brings me more joy than to bring a bunch of people together who fall in love with each other and they go off and they have their relationships and friendships that blossom. I mean, it makes me so happy. So I will be bringing in the experts to lead those discussions, but I'll just kind of sit back and enjoy.
Excellent. Well, how does someone sign up at this point?
So I do have a fledgling website that I've hacked together, and it's wildwomentribe.net. I also have an Instagram, which is @wildwomen_tribe. And then I'm on Facebook as well. So Wild Women Tribe PC.
Okay. Well, it sounds wonderful. And congratulations that on just kickstarting something that, you know, that you, like you said before, it's a passion project.
Thanks, Lynn.
I think you'll do well. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you as well. Thank you, Dave.
And we'll be back after these words. We're going to move into a film and food weekend with Park City Film Series and Eats Park City coming up Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Stay with us.
This is Charlie from Wasatch Arborists, a proud supporter of KPCW. Wasatch Arborists has been providing tree trimming, tree removal, stump grinding, and fire mitigation to residential and commercial customers in Summit and Wasatch County since 2010. More information at wasatcharborists.com or 200-5544.
Hi, I'm Margaret Schneider of Schneider Autocrossery Body and Paint. Delighted to support KPCW. Located just down the canyon in Salt Lake, we've been repairing damaged cars and getting people back on the road since 1984. We work with all insurance companies. We're open Monday through Friday in Salt Lake. Details, services, and more info at schneiderauto.net.
Hi, this is Guy Raz, host of the TED Radio Hour from NPR. Join me for the TED Radio Hour Sunday mornings at 10 right here on KPCW. Each episode takes you on a journey through the world of ideas with riveting speakers from the renowned TED stage. The show is the fastest growing program in public radio history, and it's on Sundays at 10 a.m. on KPCW.
Brought to you in part by New Park Town Center with Crandall Capital and Lisa Lundquist, Veritas Funding, loving, living, lending the Park City lifestyle.
This is The Mountain Life, healthy living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with my co-host Dave Cushing.
Well, hello, Lynn.
Hello. Wild Women Tribe. That was interesting. And let's move on to some other wild things. Food and film. It's a food and film weekend coming up Friday, Saturday, and Sunday at the Jim Santee Auditorium in conjunction with the Park City Film Series and Eats Park City. And joining us in the studio from the Park City Film Series, Katie Wang, along with Courtney Kaplan from Eats Park City. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
We have a lot of cool things coming up this weekend. And I have to point out, well, maybe Dave, you should point out your observation about the first film that's on Friday, Tampopo.
Tampopo.
Tampopo, which when I went to research this, I found a review by Roger Ebert, because this movie came out in the 80s when Roger was still with us.
That's so right.
This sounds like an amazing, like, prehistory of the noodle revolution that we're going through now.
Well, if you're Japanese, the revolution has been around for a long time. So it is built as a
We Westerners are more and more into our pho and our
ramen.
Exactly.
Well, there is nothing like freshly made ramen. I mean, it's the ramen that we get in this country for the most part. People think of the little packets in the grocery store. No, disabuse yourself.
Bad,
it's like,
bad,
it's like equating burgers with McDonald's. It's not the same thing, right? So, yes, there is a very strong food culture in Japan, particularly around ramen. So this is billed as a ramen Western. So if you're familiar with Clint Eastwood's spaghetti Westerns, it's kind of a play on that. So you have the Ronin, who are, of course, the samurai, in search of the perfect ramen. So it's very funny. It definitely has kind of a erotic tinge to it in terms of, you know, the aphrodisiacal quality of, if that's even a word, the aphrodisiac quality of food. But it's very, very funny, very classically Japanese, but something that can appeal. I think humor is something that's international. And so you really get a sense of just the humor in it, but also how seriously the Japanese take this and can also make fun of themselves for it at
the same
time.
Well, let's just step back one thing. Before we talk more about the specific movies, what's the impetus for this weekend? And I'm still kind of new to town. What is this EATS program?
This EATS program stands for Eat Awesome Things at School.
All right.
So our major focus has been to advocate for improved school food and then also set up nutrition education programs such as cooking classes, taste tests in partnership with the district, and then supporting school gardens.
Right.
And you've done this food and film weekend about 3 years?
We've actually done it for about 5 years.
Oh.
But we've partnered, we have different partners over the course of time. A few years ago when EATS kind of came out on the scene and, you know, we thought this is such a great program and we did a couple of school lunch reform films and turns out not that many people want to see that type of film. So we thought, you know, what's a different way to connect with people? And really, when I think about EATS and my kids eating good food and thinking about, you know, what kids eat in France and all these other countries and these delicious meals, it's more than just the experience at school. It's about the community that's created around food and bringing people together, you know, nutrition and community and family and all these different things. And I, like most people, like foodie films and food shows and all that. And so we thought, how about we do something a little different with EATS and help get their message out there to a different audience that maybe doesn't think of school lunch reform programs and school gardens at the same way they think about Anthony Bourdain and food waste, but perhaps they should. Right. Because these are really important messages that we should be transmitting to our children. And, you know, whether it's around the dinner table or around the lunch table. And so kind of bringing together that love of food and film and then promoting the great programs that EATS does. And it's this is our second year working with them. And it's been really fun.
Now, you've trained us, Katie, to expect the same film on three different nights with the film series. And so when it comes to the food and film weekend, we get really confused.
It's a different, it's a smorgasbord.
Yes.
So,
think of it that.
Yes, think of it as a smorgasbord. It's all food analogies.
Food tie-in.
Yes. So it's a different film every night. Same times. We don't change the times because that gets really confusing.
Yeah.
But Tampopo, the classic, which actually was just digitally remastered and re-released this year by Janus Films. So that was the impetus for that and kind of a classic. On Saturday night, we'll have The Big Sick at 8 o'clock, which is a film that premiered at the Sundance Film Festival and a very, very funny comedy. And that night will be the food pairing. So we'll have Ganesh. Catering food for that. And that's a special ticket price of $30. So you get Ganesh food along with a couple glasses of wine. You get to see the movie.
Yeah. This but is the best deal in town. I just have to note it. $30, movie ticket, two glasses of wine or a beer, obviously, either or. And then the dinner by Ganesh, which has a coconut korma, vegetarian coconut korma, a chicken tikka masala, potato biryani, lamb samosa, some naan. It is, no joke, going to be a ton of food for $30, best date night in town.
And then the movie, Big Sick, what's the food tie-in with that?
Cause have you seen it?
No, but I was reading the review on it. And,
so when you see it, there's and know. It's anyone that's not from the United States. So I'm a first-generation American. Food is very much a part of kind of your tie back to your culture. And actually, in the movie, he has a stand-up routine, Kamal, who's the main character. And
who's
in
Pakistani,
who's Pakistani.
Right. Yeah, right.
And in it, he actually has someone pass out his favorite Pakistani food. Because for him and for a lot of people who aren't from this country, that just that taste, whatever it is of your favorite food, brings you back to your home. And that's just so tied to your family. And again, kind of gets back to that cultural connection and the, you know, the family connection of what is your, you know, you think about when you're a kid, like what's your favorite dish that your grandmother made or the smell of, you know, baking bread. I mean, all those things kind of bring you together and kind of create that hominess. And so it's a light motif, certainly in the movie, but it's something, again, that we kind of wanted to highlight and thought it'd be fun to bring in Ganesh, which is such great food.
And if you haven't seen The Big Sick, this movie is hilarious. Like your belly is hurting laughing.
So eat your food first, because otherwise it's going to spray on the person in front of you. Just just saying, little
tip. It is
tip.
Such a fun movie. And yeah. if you haven't seen it at Sundance or you haven't seen it yet, please, like, you will thoroughly enjoy it.
Yeah.
So, again, on Friday, it's Tampopo, and that is just a regular viewing, no pre-service or anything.
We have some giveaways from Yukiyama, who does have ramen in their mix. Yes. They have three different types of ramen, and we have 10 giveaways for ramen from Yukiyama.
So. Oh, great.
Ramen does not travel well, so ramen, you want to eat it fresh and hot. That's so we wanted to, you know, be
so go to
honor
Yuki
the ramen.
Either that
and then
night
Sunday at 6 is Wasted, the story of food waste, narrated by Anthony Bourdain. Did
yes.
I get that right?
Oh, and it's awesome. I am a huge, I don't know, fan. I'm something that I am really interested in is food waste. And again, kind of in this country growing up, you know, with non-American parents, like you think about every culture, there's something that you do with the end bits of food, right? You make a stew, you make a curry, you make a stir fry. Mm-hmm. And in American culture, we've kind of lost touch with that. It's like, oh, it's waste. It, you know, we throw it away. And there's so much, one, carbon emissions created because of that, but also people are going hungry. That food can be reused. And so Anthony Bourdain, as a restaurateur, really takes that seriously. Every bit of food you buy is money out of your pocket if it goes into the trash can.
Right. And
so really reimagining the conversation.
40% of all food in the U.S. is wasted, according to this release.
Yeah. And I would think that this would be a big topic of discussion in this town with so many restaurants. Have you reached out to the restaurant community? Are they? I know Jody Rogers is going to be on the panel, and she's actually she's on the board of Eats. She's also the food and beverage director at Deer Valley.
Yep.
And she's very involved in this food waste.
I think it's really important, just like Katie alluded to, you're wasting money if you're throwing it away. So this is something I agree, Len, that the town can get around. And then we want to also note that, you know, when we think about schools, let's talk about food waste as well. Again, let's save the money.
Save the money and also you're squandering the opportunity to share the surplus, right?
Right. Totally. Well, and bring it back into, and the food does a really good job of breaking it down into what's the problem and then what are the solutions?
Right.
Yeah. Right. Not every bit of food can be eaten, right, after it, if it doesn't have its main purpose. It can be composted.
Yeah.
I mean, there's so many different things that it can be in its life cycle. And so we'll have a panel discussion. Lynn will be moderating that with Jody Rogers, Morgan Bowerman from Wasatch Resource Recovery, which is working on municipal-grade composting, and then Sean Peterson from Green Urban Lunchbox that works on food recovery down in the valley. So I think it's an amazing film. Anthony Bourdain is, you know, just a great...
Who doesn't
he's just
love
a great
Anthony
guy,
Bourdain.
Right? And so he does a really good job of curating the conversation and then to have something afterwards to really engage with what are the solutions in our own community and, you know, again, how can we do it starting from the school, starting from your own home, right up into our restaurants.
Right.
It's pretty exciting.
So that'll be a bit of a late night. No,
we start at
6 p.m.
Yeah, 6 p.m. So it won't be a late night.
Oh, good.
Yes. We understand it's Sunday. The panel will be following, but you'll be in bed on time.
Yeah.
Will I?
Still the school night.
Line.
It's okay.
Promise.
Yeah, we'll be good. But yeah, ParkCityFilmSeries.org. You can buy tickets, check out trailers, and come see us.
And let us know on that Saturday night because we do want to get the right head count. So again, we're not wasting food and ordering too much.
That's right. Can you show up at 7 and buy the ticket or no?
Of course,
that's going to matter.
That's how ParkCity works. Yeah. But we would love to know if you're planning on it ahead of time.
Yeah. And the food tasting does start at 7 or 7:05 because it's ParkCity time. But you know.
Right.
Excellent. Courtney Kaplan with Eats Park City and Katie Wang with the Park City Film Series. Thank you. Have a fun food and film weekend. And
we'll see you
like
Sunday
a great
night.
Time. See you Sunday
see you
night.
Sunday, yeah. Not before. Thank you.
Right on.
And let's thank our underwriters quickly. Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, San Francisco Design, Phil Davidson Orthopedics, Park City Mountain, Utah Olympic Legacy Foundation, Fairway Independent Mortgage, and Valley Behavioral Health. And to take a few seconds here and thank Dave Cushing, along with Graham Anthony, for filling in while Tim Henney has been on hiatus campaigning for city council. This will be the last week with you, Dave. But
so
you can
sad.
Come back as a guest co-host anytime. Thank you so much.
Looking forward to hearing Tim. Those were difficult shoes to fill, but it worked out.
It worked out. It's
it
been
really
fun.
Great to be here with you.
All right.
Meet all the interesting folks.
It's KPCW Park City.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by AMA Waterways and Park City Air Cruise and Travel, 565-4730, parkcityaircruiseandtravel.com. Long Reimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, lrw-law.com. Fred Marshall Painting,